Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great privilege for me to be here, Todd. Thank you for that biography. I feel incredibly privileged. I grew up in a town just like this one, started studying economics in high school just like the students at the back, and I loved it so much that I've made it my life, and I now have the best job in the country for someone who's interested in economics and public policy. So I'm incredibly privileged, and I feel honoured to be invited back to another prosperous regional community like the one that I grew up in, southern New South Wales. So thank you. Anthony, we visited the university this afternoon. That was a great experience. I was inspired by the research that was undertaken there in the animal husbandry area and also the innovation incubator which I visited. It was a fantastic experience. And the RBA has a lot to thank UNE for. You supply us with many economics graduates. It seems the agricultural economics leads into central banking somehow. But you've been supplying us with graduates for many years, and three of the major departments of the Reserve Bank are headed by graduates from the University of New England. So thank you. Tonight I would like to provide you with an economic update. I'd first like to focus on the global situation, and then I'm going to talk about the Australian economy, and finally I'll make some remarks about monetary policy here in Australia. The main message on the global economy is that while it's still growing reasonably well, the risks are increasingly tilted to the downside. The main source of these downside risks are geopolitical developments in many parts of the world. These developments are creating considerable uncertainty, and this uncertainty is causing businesses to reconsider their spending plans. And this is making the international environment quite difficult for us. On the Australian economy, I have two main messages. The first is that after having been through a soft patch, a gentle turning point seems to have been reached. While we're not expecting a return to strong economic growth in the near term, we are expecting growth to pick up a little bit. And against this backdrop, the main source of domestic uncertainty continues to be the strength of household spending. The second message is a longer-term one, and that is the fundamental factors underpinning the longer-term outlook for the Australian economy remain strong. And one of the ongoing challenges we have as a nation is to capitalise on those strong fundamentals, and I'll talk about that later on. But I want to start off with the global economy. This first graph shows global economic growth and the International Monetary Fund's forecast for the next couple of years. Looking at this graph, one might ask why the concern. Global growth has been stable and reasonable over recent times, and the IMF is forecasting that this is going to continue. If their forecasts were to come to pass, that would make for 12 years of solid economic growth. Looking at the labour markets, one might also ask what the concern is. As you can see here, unemployment rates in most advanced economies are the lowest they've been in decades, in some cases 4 or 5 decades. And businesses in many advanced economies are finding it more difficult to find workers. These tight labour markets are finally translating into stronger wages growth, and wages are now increasing at close to the rates that we saw before the financial crisis in some economies. And with inflation remaining low, the pickup in wage growth is translating into real wage increases and strong increases in household spending in a number of advanced economies. So economic growth is okay, and the labour markets in most economies are strong. So why the concern? The answer is the increased downside risks generated by the various geopolitical developments. The most prominent of these are the trade and technology disputes between the United States and China, but others include Brexit, the developments in the Middle East, the problems in Hong Kong, and the tensions between Japan and South Korea. The US-China trade disputes in particular are having a disruptive effect on international trade flows. Over the past year, there's been no growth at all in international trade, despite the global economy growing quite well, and you can see that on the left-hand side of this graph. This weakness on the trade front is flowing through into factory output around the world, with growth in global industrial production slowing considerably, as you can see on the right-hand side. More broadly, though, the geopolitical concerns are creating considerable uncertainty about the future. You can see this in this measure of economic policy uncertainty constructed from news stories in leading media outlets around the world. In the face of this uncertainty, it's not surprising that many businesses are preferring to wait before committing to significant investments. They're inclined to sit on their hands, wait for a while, and see how things play out. And this is evident in surveys of business investment intentions, which, as you can see here, have fallen considerably. The effect is also evident in June quarter GDP figures, with GDP declining in Germany, the United Kingdom, and Singapore in the June quarter. A particular concern is that if this uncertainty continues, businesses might decide not only to defer investment, but also to defer hiring workers, and this would be damaging for the global economy. Of course, it's also possible that some of the uncertainties might be resolved. If this were to happen, the global economy could grow quite strongly as firms caught up on their capital spending plans in an environment of easy financial conditions. Notwithstanding this possibility, as the downside risks have come more clearly into focus, there's been a marked shift in the outlook for global monetary policy. As you can see in this chart, almost all major central banks are expected to ease monetary policy over the next year, with the United States Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank having already moved in this direction. Given that inflation is low and forecast to remain low, investors are also expecting central banks to maintain very accommodative settings of monetary policy for years to come. This expectation is having a major effect on long-term bond yields around the world. In Europe and Japan, investors are actually paying governments to hold their money for them. The Swiss government, for example, can borrow for 30 years at a negative interest rate of -0.5%. It's remarkable. For the world as a whole, around a quarter of the total stock of government bonds on issue have negative yields at the moment. Again, remarkable. And where yields are in positive territory, they're at very low levels, and in many cases, they're the lowest on record. That's the case in Australia as well. All this is making for a challenging international environment for us. I'd now like to turn to the Australian economy. Over recent times, our economy has been going through a soft patch, as you can see in this chart. Over the year to June, GDP grew by just 1.4%, which is the slowest year-ended growth for some years. We didn't expect this slowdown to take place, so it's come as a bit of a surprise to us. It's important, though, that we do keep things in perspective. The economic expansion in Australia has now been running for 28 years. That's quite an achievement, and it's one that's not matched elsewhere around the world. Over such a long expansion, there are going to be ebbs and flows in the growth rate. There are going to be periods where growth exceeds expectations, as it did in the first half of last year, and there are going to be other periods like now where growth is weaker than expected. With the benefit of hindsight, though, there are a few factors that help explain the slowing in the Australian economy over the past year. One is the international developments that I just spoke about. While Australia has been less directly affected by the US-China trade disputes than many other economies, there is an indirect effect through slower global growth and increased uncertainty. The second and more important factor is weak consumption growth. Over the past year, there has been no growth at all in consumption per capita in Australia. That's a very unusual outcome at a time when employment's growing strongly. An important part of the explanation here is that household disposable income has been increasing only very slowly for an extended period, reflecting subdued wage increases and strong growth in taxes paid. The persistence of slow growth in household incomes has led many people to reassess how fast their incomes will increase in the future. And as they've done this, they've also reassessed their spending, particularly on discretionary items, which has been quite weak over recent times. You can see that in the red bars in this chart. Not surprisingly, perhaps spending on household essentials has been less affected. That's shown in the blue bars there. Another part of the explanation for weak growth in household spending is the adjustment in the housing market. As housing prices have fallen, there's been a marked decline in housing turnover. As you can see here, the turnover rate has declined to the lowest that it's been in many decades. With few of us moving homes, spending on new furniture and household appliances has been very soft, and so too has expenditure on moving costs and real estate fees. And more broadly, the correction in the housing market has also affected the economy through its impact on residential construction activity. A third contributing factor to the slower growth has been the drought, and you know this better than others. Across the Murray-Darling Basin, including here in the Northern Tablelands, farmers have faced extremely dry conditions. Indeed, as you can see in this graph, in some areas conditions have been the driest on record, and that's shown by the dark red colour in this graph, and there's way too much dark red. Reflecting this, farm output in Australia has fallen for the past 2 years, and there's been a sharp drop in farm income as farmers have had to cope with increased costs of obtaining both feed and water. These difficult conditions have contributed to the weakness in overall household incomes and consumption, and the effects are particularly felt in regional communities, including here in Armidale. The drought has also put upward pressure on food prices over the past year, particularly for bread, milk, and meat. So we're all hoping that the drought breaks soon. But even after accounting for these three factors, this slowdown overseas, the weak growth in household disposable incomes and the drought, part of the slowing in the Australian economy remains unexplained. This is especially so once we take into account the labour market data, which continue to paint a fairly strong picture of the economy. Over recent times, employment growth has been stronger than was expected. Over the past year, the number of people with a job in Australia has increased by 2.5%. That's a strong outcome, and it follows strong outcomes in the two previous years. Reconciling this with GDP growth of just 1.5% remains a challenge for us, because normally output growth exceeds employment growth rather than fall short, as it has just recently. We're trying to understand what's going on here. It's possible that it's just measurement noise, but we can't rule out something more structural, and if it were more structural, it'd be quite serious. The other striking feature of the labour market over recent times has been a large rise in labour supply. In particular, there's been a very large lift in labour force participation by women and by older Australians. You can see this in this chart. As a result, the increase in labour supply has more than outstripped the increase in labour demand, which has itself been strong. Reflecting this, and despite the strong employment growth, the unemployment rate has moved higher since the start of the year to 5.25%. This increase in labour supply is undoubtedly a positive development, but it does mean that it's proving quite difficult to generate a tight labour market, with the flow-on consequence that wage increases remain subdued. Over the past year, the wage price index increased by just 2.3%. As you can see, this is a pickup from the rates of recent years, but the lift in wages growth looks to have stalled recently. And another relevant factor here is the ongoing caps on wage increases in the public sectors across the country. Low wage growth is one of the factors contributing to low inflation outcomes. Over the year to June, inflation was just 1.6%, and that was both in headline and underlying terms, as you can see in this chart. One contributing factor to these low inflation outcomes is the adjustment in the housing market, with rents increasing at the slowest rate in decades and declines being recorded in the price of building a new home in some cities. You can see that in the top right-hand panel of this graph. Another factor is various government initiatives to address cost of living pressures, with these initiatives pushing down inflation in administered prices. As you can see, the price rises for utilities are also much lower than they have been over recent years. So all these factors are weighing on the inflation outcomes for the country as a whole. Working in the other direction just recently, the drought and the depreciation of the exchange rate have been pushing up retail prices for a while now. But looking forward, there are some signs that after a soft patch, the economy has reached a gentle turning point. This is evident in the fact that GDP growth over the first half of this year was stronger than it was over the second half of last year. You can see that in the pickup in those bars at the bottom of this graph. And we're expecting a further modest pickup in the quarters ahead. This outlook for an improving economy is supported by a number of developments, including lower interest rates, the recent tax cuts, the depreciation of the Australian dollar, ongoing spending on infrastructure, the stabilisation of the housing market in some cities, and a brighter outlook for the resources sector. It is reasonable to expect that together, these factors will see growth in the Australian economy return to around its trend rate over the next year or so, although there are some obvious risks to this outlook. One factor that should help is an expected pickup in household disposable income. Many households are currently receiving larger tax refunds due to the lower and middle income tax offsets. These payments will boost aggregate disposable income by 0.6% this year, which is a material increase, and past experience suggests that around half of these tax refunds will be spent over coming quarters. Household disposable income is also being boosted by lower interest rates, although the effect is obviously uneven across the community, with lower rates reducing the incomes of households who rely on interest income. Household spending should also be supported by an increase in housing turnover. Working in the other direction, though, is a further contraction in residential construction activity. Another positive element is likely to come from the resources sector. As you can see in this chart, mining investment is expected to increase over the next year. That's after it declined for 6 years in a row as the LNG investment boom wound down. Mining companies are increasing their investment not only to sustain their current production, but in some cases to expand capacity as well. And there's also been a welcome pickup in exploration activity recently. To be clear, and as you can see, we're not predicting a return to boom time conditions in the resources sector, but we are predicting better times ahead for the sector. Business investment elsewhere in the economy is also expected to move higher. Earlier I discussed how uncertainty globally is affecting the outlook for investment in many economies. Fortunately, we don't see the same spike in the measure of policy uncertainty in Australia that we saw in that earlier graph for the world as a whole. There has, however, been some softening in measures of business conditions recently, from levels that were well above average to levels that are around average now. The investment outlook is also being supported by a solid pipeline of infrastructure projects. This ongoing investment in infrastructure is not only supporting demand in the economy at a time when it's needed, but it's also adding to supply capacity and directly improving people's lives, including through providing better services and reducing transport congestion, which is a major issue in our cities. Together, it's reasonable to expect that these various factors will see growth pick up from here. Apart from the international uncertainties, the main source of uncertainty around this outlook continues to be the strength of household spending. And we will need to see a pickup in household income growth for household spending to pick up. Whether that takes place, time will tell. As we grapple with these issues, though, it is important not to lose sight of the fact that the Australian economy has some strong fundamentals. Australia is fortunate in having enviable endowments of natural resources, both in terms of minerals and agricultural land. We have a reputation as a highly reliable supplier and producer of high-quality, clean food, and we continue to build on that reputation through the research being undertaken by universities, including here in Armidale. We also have strong and close links with the rapidly growing countries of Asia. Three of the four most populous countries in the world, China, India, and Indonesia, are all in our neighbourhood. And our ties with these countries are strengthened by the many people from there who live, work, and study in Australia. Our demographics are also reasonably favourable. Our population is ageing less quickly than that of many other advanced economies. The population is also growing relatively rapidly for an advanced economy. Last year it grew by 1.7%. That compares with just 0.6% in the United States and declining populations in many countries in North Asia and in Europe. It's a big difference. Immigration has been a strong contributor to this. Almost half of us were born overseas or who have one parent who was born overseas. While we've struggled to meet the infrastructure needs that come with the growing population, it does bring a dynamism that is not easily matched in countries with declining population. We also have a highly talented, flexible and adaptive workforce. We have strong public institutions, a well-established macroeconomic framework, and the rule of law is respected in Australia. There's also a demonstrated record of responsible fiscal policy and public debt is low. And finally, we benefit from having both a flexible exchange rate and a flexible labour market. So our fundamentals are strong and we shouldn't forget that. The challenge we face is to fully capitalise on those strong fundamentals. If we can do this, then I'm confident that we can once again experience strong growth in real incomes in Australia. I'd like to finish with some remarks about monetary policy. As you would be aware, the Reserve Bank Board lowered the cash rate in June and July to a new low of just 1%. Financial markets are pricing in further reductions in the cash rate over the next year. Our decisions and the expectations of investors about the future reflect both international and domestic factors. On the international front, as I discussed earlier, interest rates around the world are low and they're moving lower. There are many reasons for this, but the central reason is that the global appetite to save is elevated relative to the global appetite to use those savings to invest in new productive capital. When lots of people want to save, and there's not much demand for those savings, savers inevitably earn low returns. We live in an interconnected world, which means that we cannot completely insulate ourselves from long-lasting shifts in global interest rates. Our floating exchange rate does give us a degree of monetary independence, but we can't ignore structural shifts in global interest rates. If we did seek to ignore those shifts, our exchange rate would appreciate, which in the current environment would be unhelpful in terms of achieving both the inflation target and full employment. As I've spoken about on other occasions, the key to more normal interest rates globally is addressing the factors that are leading to a depressed appetite to invest relative to the appetite to save. Whether or not this will happen, time will tell. But as a small open economy, we have to take the world and global interest rates as we find them. On the domestic front, there has been an accumulation of evidence over recent times that the economy can sustain lower rates of unemployment and underemployment than is previously thought likely. The flexibility of labour supply also means that strong rates of employment growth can be sustained without inflation becoming a problem. They're both positive developments. Inflation has been below the 2 to 3% medium-term target for some time, for the reasons I spoke about earlier. And looking ahead, inflation is expected to pick up, but it is expected to remain below the midpoint of the target range for some time to come. The decisions to ease monetary policy in June and July were taken to help make more assured progress towards full employment in Australia and achieving the inflation target. And further monetary easing may well be required, while we are at a gentle turning point and expect growth to pick up. The strength and durability of this pickup remains to be seen. But regardless of the short-term outlook for monetary policy, the point about the solution to low global interest rates is relevant in Australia too. We'll all be better off if businesses have the confidence to expand, invest, innovate, and hire people. Given Australia's strong fundamentals, this is not out of our reach, but it does require constant effort. At our board meeting next week, we will again take stock of the evidence. It's nevertheless likely that an extended period of low interest rates will be required in Australia to make progress in reducing unemployment and achieving more assured progress towards the inflation target. The board is prepared to ease monetary policy further if needed to support sustainable growth in the economy, make further progress towards full employment, and achieve the inflation target over time. So thank you very much for listening, and I'd be delighted to answer some questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony, very much. And thank you, Dr. Lowe, for an intriguing and comprehensive overview of what's happening globally and domestically and what your thoughts are on the outlook for the Australian economy. Could I first, just to make my job a little easier, the journalists, the media people in the room, could you just give me an indication of where you are, please? Right, if you could also come to the microphone when you have your questions, we might get that underway. Could we have the first question, please?
You mentioned that markets are anticipating further monetary easing in the coming year. In fact, in recent days, markets have been anticipating that the BOC have priced an 80% probability for a move next Tuesday. At the same time, since the Reserve Bank cut in June and July, capital city house prices have been rising, and rising quite smartly. Over the past two or three months, I think the annualised rate's about 10%. I was speaking to some people here today, and I think there was a report this week that New South Wales agricultural land prices have risen in the past year despite the drought, which is a bit unusual. But so my question is it realistic for markets to think there's an 80% probability of a move next week? And if so, what should we think about house prices? Is it a problem that house prices are rising strongly again? Maybe in the next 18 months they'll go to new highs. Is that a problem, or is that just the transmission mechanism for monetary policy that drives a stronger economy, that drives a stronger labour market?
Well, thank you. There are a few issues there. I'm not going to comment on the market's assessment of what we're going to do next month. But the market is forecasting cuts in further easing of monetary policy over the next year, and I think that's a reasonable expectation. The timing will depend on really our assessment of the data. On the housing market, it's true that prices have risen for a few months in a row now. We've got to remember, for 18 months in a row, prices fell in Sydney and Melbourne, and they came down 15%, and they've just come up a couple of percent. So I'm not particularly concerned about that. There are a few factors at work. Lower interest rates are obviously one. The removal of the uncertainty about the tax arrangements for investor housing is another, and there's been some easing of the prudential requirements. It seems to me quite possible that we could have a period now of rising housing prices, because construction activity is slowing and the population is still rising quite quickly as well. So there are some underlying drivers of housing prices, and from a monetary policy perspective, it's not an issue at the moment. It would become an issue if credit growth accelerated rapidly, but I see no signs of that at the moment. Many households are a bit reluctant to borrow. It's not surprising when their incomes aren't growing strongly, and banks are still a bit reluctant to lend. So the demand for credit is fairly weak, the supply is fairly weak as well. So in the current environment, I'm not particularly concerned about a borrowing binge again. If that would emerge, it would be an issue, but it's not on today's agenda. Thank you.
Thanks, Rory. Thanks, Dr. Lowe. Next question, please.
Matt Hanson from the Financial Review. Just two short questions.
Sorry, I'm having trouble with that. Sorry, we're having trouble hearing. Is that the problem with the microphone?
Is that any better?
Slightly. Can it come up a bit higher, please?
Does that work?
That's perfect. Thank you.
All right. So, two quick questions. First is, as Rory mentioned, 80% chance is what the financial markets are pricing up next Tuesday. I'm wondering, how much of a bearing does financial market predictions have on the timing of your easing policy? Do you feel any pressure from the financial markets when it comes to that easing policy? And do you feel any pressure from any other areas?
Before you go on with your second question, I feel no pressure from the pricing in financial markets. What our board does is do what we think is right for the country. And we're looking at trends in inflation, the labour market and output growth. They're the things we focus on, not what financial markets are saying. So I feel no pressure from financial markets or from any other quarter. We do what we think is right.
I suppose in the matter of that, it may just be that some people are thinking you're less data dependent now and your decisions might be through other areas, what's happening in the geopolitical space and so forth, which the financial market pricing.
I mean, the data are always very important to our decisions, but we will make an assessment of what's going on with the labour market and the likely growth in output and inflation. So we'll have to make another assessment at our board meeting, and we rely on the constant flow of data, and we don't feel pressure from anyone. So.
Okay, good. So the second question is in regards to what happened with the New York Federal Reserve last week. There was an issue where they had to intervene in the market. Some people have just said that was just like a plumbing issue. What's your opinion on what happened there? And do you think the RBA may ever have to intervene in the same way that they did?
Now, I don't want to have a running commentary on US Federal Reserve monetary operations. But what they're finding is what we've experienced over the past couple of years, that the financial markets, and particularly the repo market, is very sensitive to fairly small shifts in supply and demand. Once upon a time, banks were happy to operate in these markets. They were prepared to devote capital and resources to providing market-making activities. But changes in financial regulation have made banks much less willing to do this. And we've seen our repo rate move around quite a lot over time. In the US, they're now experiencing the same dislocation. And they're having to respond to it. We've got a very flexible approach to our monetary operations, so we've been able to deal with it quite effectively, and the Fed is now learning that he has to have this flexibility as well. I don't think it has any broader implications.
Thanks, Gavin. Do you mind if I just ask one quick one?
No.
You just mentioned the bonds, a remark you kept on saying were quite remarkable. It's now about $15 trillion worth of negative yielding bonds around the world. Do you think there could be a bit of a bond bubble?
I don't like the word bubble, but I think, as I said in my remarks, the reason interest rates are so low is lots and lots of people around the world want to save, and there aren't many businesses saying, I'll take some of those savings and invest them in new productive capital. And the result of that is that savers are getting low returns.
Dr. Lowe, thank you for coming to Armidale. A couple of very quick questions, and you might give me some quick answers. I'm not from the FIMA view, by the way. I'm Bernie Perkins, and I'm asking the question as an ex-farmer. When you get together with the other central bankers around the world, like Draghi, Carney, Powell, etc., you must be starting to discuss as a group the fact that very low rates are not stimulating the world economy. And of course, many of them have gone to the quantitative easing. And we've seen in Japan in the 1990s that didn't work. And there's a new point as to whether it's worked in America now, because they couldn't complete their cycle of other interest rate rises. If you get to the point here in Australia where you get your rates down to zero, would you consider the quantitative easing? And secondly, where's inflation gone? Has it gone in with technology changes, has it gone in the internet? Where has inflation gone to?
Well, there are a lot of elements of that question. The first one is when I get together with my colleagues from the other central banks, which I do at least every 2 months, because I go to Basel every 2 months where the central bank governors get together. And over recent times, the issue we've been discussing more frequently than other issues is monetary policy carrying too much of the burden globally? And the answer the central banks come to, probably not surprising given who we are, is that we do feel there is too much burden being placed on monetary policy. What we would like to see is a stronger demand for the global pool of savings by businesses wanting to invest. This is why I talk so much about creating an environment where firms want to expand, invest, innovate and hire people. Because that will be the solution. That requires structural reform, I think, and there are policies that that could be implemented there which would make a difference to create an environment where firms do want to expand, and that would take some of the weight off monetary policy. You asked whether we would consider quantitative easing. The answer to that is yes, there are circumstances where we would. I think it's unlikely, and I certainly hope we don't have to do it, but it's possible. And we've studied the mechanics of how we would do it. We've drawn on the experience of overseas. We've been involved in a lot of international groups that have looked at how it's worked. So we know how to do it, and we've done something about under what conditions we would do it, but I think it's unlikely, and I certainly hope that we don't have to go in that direction. Where's the inflation gone? As I showed in one of those graphs, at the moment, rent inflation is the lowest in decades. That's to do with issues in the housing market. At the moment, the government is reducing the prices of the services it delivers to the community to relieve cost of living pressures, and utility price inflation has gone down as well. More fundamentally, though, wage inflation is very low. It used to be the case in Australia that, on average, people look forward to wage increases of 3.5% or 4% a year. At the moment, kind of most people accept 2%. They're not happy about it, but they accept it. So there's been a ratcheting down of the wage norms. And with wages only increasing at 2%, it's not surprising that inflation's kind of a bit below 2%. So that's a fundamental factor, and then you've got these issues of rents and administrative prices on top of it.
Just before the next question, could I just ask a follow-on from that? You talked about the contribution that the infrastructure spending is making to the economy in that gentle turnaround, as you called it. Do you think, and I'm not sure how far down the Canberra Trail you wish to stray at any one time, but do you think that we're seeing sufficient infrastructure spending in the economy?
Well, that's a very political question, and let me give you the answer that I've given before. I think on the large mega projects in Sydney and Melbourne, I don't think at the moment there's very much capacity to do more mega projects. The construction costs are rising, there are capacity constraints. But where I do see the potential to do more is smaller projects, particularly in the areas of maintenance, road, rail, bridges, and in the regions. And I sense there is capacity. People tell me this, that for these smaller, mid-sized projects, there is capacity. And if we need to support the economy, then that might be one area to look. So I accept the point on the big mega projects, there's not much more, but smaller projects right across the country that use Australian contractors, employ workers and create demand, I think that we should be looking at that.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Dr. Lowe, I'm Mike Morton. I'm Executive Director of Practical Systems, and we're an agricultural technology developer. And likewise, share the same birthplace as yourself in a similar time frame. Dr. Lowe, I appreciate a bit of a left field, reason to ask a left field question. In travelling around Australia, particularly the eastern seaboard, and conducting business in drought affected areas, I'd be interested in a view of where climate change sits with the Reserve Bank, not if it's happening, but in framing the risk discussion. And you made mention of businesses' lack of willingness to invest. And I'm wondering if you have a view, or the Reserve Bank has a view, in climate change in framing that risk appetite.
Well, it's increasingly clear that climate change is having an effect on the economy and on our financial institutions. We're seeing extreme weather events that are more costly. That's leading at the moment to an increase in the cost of some insurance, and in some areas you can't get insurance. That's affecting investment decisions. We're seeing increased possibility of stranded assets in various industries and various locations, and the repair cost for building infrastructure after extreme weather events is also higher. And that's having implications for government budgets and for insurers and other financial institutions. So it's a material issue. Climate change is obviously affecting investment decisions about power generation, how we do that, and it's creating uncertainty for businesses and for individuals. It's affecting agricultural production, as we know, in this part of the country. So the effects are wide-ranging, and financial institutions are having to deal with these risks. Insurers most directly, but asset managers as well. and it's introducing potentially volatility into the macro economy as well. So it's a real issue, and we're paying quite a lot of attention to what's going on. There's nothing we can do about it, but we've got to understand the implications about the economy and financial markets, and the Deputy Governor of the RBA has given a couple of speeches on this issue.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Dr. Lowe, thank you very much for coming to our beautiful city. My name is Andrew Drayden. I've perhaps got a question similar to what was asked previously, but from a different angle. As we near closer to zero interest rates, are we seeing a reduction in the effectiveness of monetary policy as a mechanism for stimulating economic growth, or should we be asking Mr. Joyce, who's probably going to ask the same question behind me, whether we should be having greater fiscal stimulus in the economy? I ask this with the observation that, you know, corporates are holding back on investment due to the global issues that we're facing. It seems to be quite inelastic to interest rates. We have an aging population, and low interest rates seem to be holding on to their money rather than spending it, as we would hope, and perhaps indeed propping up artificially the share market at the moment as well. And also, as pointed out, since the Royal Commission, banks seem to be more reluctant to issue credit. That's my question. Also, you talk a lot about wage growth being so important. Didn't we have some of the highest wages in the world? Why is that so important?
Yeah. Well, again, there are a few issues. Has monetary policy become ineffective? The answer to that is no. But I do think it has become less effective at the margin. Once upon a time, when we lowered interest rates, people would run off to the bank to borrow, to kind of either go on a holiday or get furniture or kind of do some spending. They don't do that anymore. When we lower interest rates, they're more likely to go to the bank and say, look, I want to pay off my mortgage. You know, I can do this more quickly now. So that has changed. But there are two mechanisms that still work as they always did. The first is the exchange rate. Just to think about the scenario where we hadn't lowered interest rates, where would the Australian dollar be? I think it would be higher than where it is now, and that would not be helpful for jobs or inflation. And the cash flow effect from lower interest rates still works. For every dollar of interest income received by the household sector, the households pay more than $2 of interest to the bank. So when interest rates come down, there's a net cash flow addition to the household sector. It's uneven, but there's a net addition. So that still works. You asked about fiscal policy, and I don't want to comment again on that tonight, but the point I want to emphasise is that we need to create this environment where firms want to invest. And fiscal expansion might do that, but the real way that you do that is through structural reform that gives firms an incentive to invest, expand, innovate, and hire people. And for me, that's the priority both domestically and globally, because interest rates are going to stay low for a long period of time unless firms want to use global savings to build new capital. That's the challenge we face, and how do we best do that? And I think there are things that both government and business can do.
Next question, Mr. Joyce, just one second. Can I just ask a question? The geopolitical issues you talked about and the pessimistic outlook that generally has, do you think that's feeding more loudly into the outlook for business and their reluctance to invest? Is that sort of, do you have a way to measure that, or is it a sense of that's a big contributing factor to reluctance?
Well, what we see, I show in the graphs, the measure of global policy uncertainty is extraordinarily high. And we also see in the surveys that businesses right around the world are asking, do you intend to invest? And they're saying no. And then the liaison that our central bank is doing and other central banks are doing, and they ask businesses, why aren't you investing? They say, well, it's all very uncertain. We don't know what the trade and technology landscape is going to look like. There's underlying uncertainty about technology as well. So we're just going to sit on our hands for a while. And it's been okay up until now because firms have hired workers. They're not investing at the rate that they might have otherwise done, but they're prepared to hire workers. And one of the risks that the central bank community is worried about is firms might decide they don't want to hire workers either. So addressing the underlying factors that are leading to a lack of investment, I think, is the fundamental challenge. We can move the monetary and fiscal levers, but unless we make firms want to invest, I think we're going to be in this world of low interest rates for a long, long time.
Next question, someone who's no stranger to the audience, the member for New England, Mr. Barbie Joyce.
Well, now thank you very much, and I apologise for taking somebody else's place for a second. It reminds me back at Senate Economics Committee, so I'm going to take an opportunity. I'm just going to ask one question, and it's pertinent to what's happening at the moment. We see that we are politically aligned to the US, we're economically tied to China, the two are in a trade war. What happens to us economically if we fall economically out of bed with the Chinese in regards to our reliance on them? And what is the plan of the Reserve Bank if that event was to occur?
I'm not sure that what the exact scenario is, but if our economic relationship with China were to deteriorate and our exports to China were to decline, that would have a first-order effect on the Australian economy. A lot of the prosperity that we currently enjoy is because we're able to sell our resources, both minerals and agricultural resources, to China at high prices. It's been the story of Australia over the past decade. So what happens in the Chinese economy is incredibly important to Australia, and our relationship with the US is very important as well. In the event that our relationship with China were to deteriorate and we weren't able to sell our resources at the high prices, we'd obviously have to find other markets. We'd probably find those markets, but the prices would be lower and our exchange rate would be lower. So the exchange rate is actually the great stabiliser of the Australian economy. If we couldn't sell the resources as we can sell them now, the exchange rate would come down and we'd all have to get used to lower living standards. That would be the core adjustment mechanism, and the scenario you paint, we could ease monetary policy further, but there's not that much space there to do that. So I certainly hope that scenario doesn't come to pass.
A couple more questions. Are there any more journalists who have questions? Right. Thank you. Of course.
I have maybe two questions here. The first one I wanted to ask about unemployment. So our unemployment rate is currently fairly low. I think it's a fair comment, below 4%. And you suggest it might go lower. Is there a floor? And what should, I guess, monetary and fiscal policy leaders around the country do to push it lower than,
Is there a floor to the unemployment rate? The answer to that is surely yes, but the floor is much lower than we used to think. I mean, you see in the US, they used to think the unemployment rate could, you know, maybe go 5%, and now it's kind of 3-point-something. And you know, in Germany, the unemployment rate's the lowest in 40 years at rates that they didn't think they could achieve, and the same in the UK. So I think the same can happen in Australia. We can have a lower unemployment rate than we've got now. Our best guess is 4.5% constitutes full employment, but hopefully when we get there, we'll find the numbers even lower again. We haven't got a hard and fast view about what full employment constitutes, but it's certainly lower than where we are now. How do we get there? Well, part of our strategy is to have interest rates low for a long period of time, and hopefully that will stimulate a strong labour market. We'd like to see the labour market tighten up. Someone asked before, it kind of seemed to be implying that, well, there's a problem because wages in Australia are too high. I don't accept that. We have high wages here because we have relatively high productivity. We're a prosperous, wealthy country, and our workers should get paid well. And I think over time we should go back to wage increases starting with a 3. If we're going to deliver you an average inflation rate of 2.5%, which is core to our mandate, and there's labour productivity growth of 1% a year, and workers get their normal share of that, then wages should be increasing in steady state at 3.5%. That's from where I sit, that's kind of central bank nirvana. Wage growth at 3.5% to 4%, reasonable productivity growth, full employment, and inflation averaging 2.5%. That's what I'd like to see. Whether we're going to get there or not, I don't know, but I think it's achievable. So I think if we can create a tighter labour market, that's the key. And it's proving, as I said in my remarks, quite hard to create a tight labour market. We've done a very good job of creating a lot of labour demand. Employment's growing 2.5% for 3 years in a row. That's very strong. But every time there's more labour demand, there's more labour supply. I learned in first year economics at high school. You know, it's the balance of supply and demand, and they both are strong. And You know, it's good because more and more people have jobs. A higher share of the Australian population have a job today than ever before in our history. That's the good news. But because labour supply is so flexible, wage growth isn't picking up. Anyhow, that was a bit long.
Yeah, I guess my other question has to do with that, with the lumpiness of our employment sector. In some communities in regional Australia, we have completely full employment to the point where there's no housing to be had. Those are examples of that. But in other areas, smaller towns and Glenners tend to deal with very high employment rates. Do you think policymakers should think, turn their mind to how to make it more even across Australia and to ensure that, I guess, wage increase occurs everywhere? Or do you think that this problem is
You've moved beyond my area of expertise. The Reserve Bank's mandate's a national mandate, so I look very much at the aggregate unemployment rate. But I'll observe, I think as you did, that the average unemployment rate outside the capital cities is pretty much the same as the average unemployment rate in the capital cities. But within the regional communities, you're right, there's huge dispersion. Monetary policy can't do anything about that. Should others? I don't know, I'll leave that to others to answer.
Governor Michael here from Bloomberg News. I'm not contractually obliged to ask this question, but I feel like I must. In May, when we were in Brisbane, you said that people shouldn't be surprised if the bank goes and cuts rates, and in June we cut. This time next week, should people be surprised if you cut rates?
I genuinely didn't hear, but I probably didn't want to hear the question. So I didn't hear the kind of...
Pick the microphone up, please.
Oh, okay. Well, in Brisbane in May, you said people shouldn't be surprised if you cut rates, and in June you cut. This time next week, will people be surprised? Should people be surprised if you cut rates?
I'm not going to answer that. You should expect us to act consistent with our mandate. And you should be surprised if we don't do that.
Okay. A more serious question here. You mentioned the potential structural issues in terms of hiring, moving a lot faster than GDP growth. Could you outline what you're sort of thinking there? What sort of factors might be at play there?
I don't really have any good answers because it's a bit of a mystery. As I said, employment growth 2.5%, output growth 1.5%. That's an unusual configuration because normally output grows more quickly than employment. At a simple accounting level, it suggests that productivity growth in the economy slowed down. If that were to be the issue, I think we've got a serious issue to confront for the country as a whole. And we don't really have a good explanation for why productivity growth would have slowed down right at the moment. So it's possible there's measurement error, because these things are hard to measure. So if it continues, though, we'll have to face the challenge of weak productivity growth and do something about that. But I don't have a clear explanation at the moment.
Thank you. Could you just make sure you pick the microphone up and hold it a bit closer so that everyone can hear, please?
Yeah, I'm Jackson from Oakland Catholic College. I just have a quick question about what do you believe the effect of low interest rates will have on superannuation, especially for younger generations going into the long-term future?
Well, by the time you retire, I'm hoping that businesses want to use the pool of global savings to invest in great capital and fund new innovation. If that's what happens, then asset prices will be higher and firms will be profitable, and you can look forward to strong growth in your superannuation balances. But in the short term, lower interest rates aren't going to do very much to superannuation. I think they will push up asset prices a bit, and that helps in the short run. But superannuation is about the long run, and the long run is about capital formation, development, innovation, and building businesses. So people often look for monetary policy to solve for kind of the issue of the day, and sometimes it's the right thing to do to look for monetary policy. But there are deeper issues we've got to address. How do we make firms expand, innovate, hire people and invest? And interest rates, in the end, don't do that, do they? It's business dynamism. It's people like you, not me, who can get firms to do that, and government can play a role as well.
Wilma Flanagan, semi-retired farmer, and unlike Jackson, I don't have quite that long until I'm really retired. And so I am concerned about interest rates. But my other question
Sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you.
You might need the microphone.
My other question is, you've studiously avoided mentioning the rather large level of corporate and government debt in the world and its effect on fiscal and monetary policy and the restrictions that that puts upon it. I just wondered if you'd like to make a comment about that.
Well, we're talking globally, not about Australia here. I mean, public debt is very high globally, and it's a significant issue because it means if there's a downturn, the capability to respond with fiscal policy is less than it would be if we had lower levels of public debt. And Australia provides a really good example of what can happen on the positive side if you run responsible fiscal policy. In the financial crisis, we had one of the larger fiscal expansions around the world. I mean, it's debated whether the that was necessary or not. But we were able to do that, and the Australian government was able to do that and support the economy because we'd run responsible fiscal policy for many years before. I think this is a consideration for the current government to get back to budget balance to give us that flexibility in the future. Many other countries do not have that flexibility. We saw in the financial crisis that some of the worst affected countries actually had to tighten fiscal policy in the crisis. And that's because the high level of public debt. And we don't, unfortunately in Australia, we're not in that situation. So it's a significant issue. And next question.
Maureen McKenzie, I'm from Homes North Community Housing. I'm the CEO. I wanted to ask a question about housing affordability. And you mentioned concerns that that rent increases have been met at the lowest for some time. How do you reconcile this with housing affordability? So if a positive outcome for the economy is increases in rent, how do you reconcile that with an ever diminishing affordability of housing rents?
Yeah. If I suggested that slow growth in rents was a concern, I misspoke. And it's an issue with inflation. And inflation, the aggregate inflation rate's too low from my perspective. And rents have a large weight in the CPI. And rent inflation is very weak. So that's one factor holding down inflation. So that was the context that I mentioned it. The weak growth in rents is actually making rental accommodation more affordable for many people. So from that perspective, it's good. And hopefully, if rent inflation is weak, people have a bit more income and they can spend elsewhere in the economy, and that extra spending is good for demand and actually pushes up prices somewhere else. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to correct you. I think this is actually it's a positive development from housing affordability, but from a very micro perspective, getting inflation back to 2.5%, it's a bit of an issue. But I think if people aren't spending on rent, hopefully they're spending somewhere else in the economy. And
can I just add something to that, though? That I think another problem is that as an asset class is seen as an ever increasing need for it to increase in value all the time, and that then increases pressure on rental returns for investors.
Yeah, you're right.
No answers for that.
Well, any holder of an asset wants the asset to go up in value, don't they? I mean, that's why we hold assets, partly to kind of get capital appreciation. Over time, the rental yields have come down, so the prices have gone up by more than rents. But this is a global phenomenon. When interest rates are low, right around the world for a long period of time, the risk-adjusted rate of return on all assets has to be low as well. Another way of saying that is the asset prices go up relative to the flow of dividends or rents from the assets. So that's one of the consequences of lower interest rates. Risk-adjusted rates of return on all assets go low, become very low as well. We mightn't like it, but that's the way that it is. And the only you'll get sick of me saying this. The way to get around this is having an environment where firms want to expand, invest, innovate, and hire people. The central banks can't solve this problem for you.
Thank you. We've got a question from a student. Just make sure that microphone's right up close, please.
In light of the increasingly negative effects of the drought in the rural region, does the central bank have any prospects to try and stimulate the sector? And how would they go about this, and what would the likely effects be?
Well, the short answer is no, we don't have any kind of tools to do it. I mean, what the central bank does is print the banknotes, set the overnight interest rate and responsible financial stability and run the payment system. I mean, if we get those things right, it's good for the economy, but it's not going to help with the drought. So there's nothing that the central bank itself can do. And there are other arms of public policy that can do things, but unfortunately, we can't do anything for the regional communities affected by the drought other than to run decent macroeconomic policy. I'd like to be able to do more for you, but I've got a mandate, and my mandate is price stability, full employment, and the economic prosperity of the total people of Australia. So, and the tools are the overnight interest rate, financial stability, and operating the payment system. Yep, so we don't really have a mandate or the tools to do it, so I'm sorry.
Thanks for coming to Armand. I'll do a little bit of Taz. We put up this question, but so currently Australia's CEOs are averaging above $20 million in annual payment. You said household consumption's currently quite low. There's quite a high rate of salary at the top end. Does that have a flow effect to wage increases for the bottom line workers?
Yes, so I heard the comment.
The CEOs of Australia are on quite high salaries.
Yeah,
does that limit the household spending for the average Australian worker?
Yeah. Yep, so is the question, is that good, bad, or what do I think about that?
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Well, I think kind of as a regular Australian, it disturbs me. Now, you've got some people who are paid extraordinarily high amounts of money, and working Australians are have relatively low wages and getting small wage increases. I think it's an issue for the society. The idea is that if you pay senior executives bonuses or high salaries, they'll actually work harder. I know I've got a flat salary, and I say to my board, look, don't even consider performance pay.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm going to work as hard for you and for the people of Australia, regardless of my pay. Actually, I think a lot of people are like that. If you're paid well like I am, you know, the pay isn't the thing that motivates you, but it's actually doing a good job. And you know, so that's my mindset. So I can't understand the mindset that says we have to pay you $5 or $10 or $20 million so that you deliver value for the company. But that's the mindset that many investors have and many people in the business community have. It's not a mindset that I share. You pay people well. I'm paid extraordinarily well. And I do the job because I want to make a difference. Actually, I think many senior people in organisations have that mindset. So I'd like to see that mindset be more widespread accepted in the community. And people say, look, I don't need these mega salaries. I want to do the job because it's the right thing to do. I'm going to work hard. I don't need these big incentives. My incentive is to do a good job for the people I serve. So that's my kind of lecture.
Okay. That's it. More questions, please? Just nice and close with that microphone.
James here from Regional Development Australia, Northern England, and I'm a recent graduate from the Great University of New England as well. So, and I don't think I'll ever get a chance to ask this sort of question to someone like you ever again, but I'm interested in the opportunity our region has for the Inland Rail. The biggest drawbacks that I've come across so far is a low risk tolerance for business investment in the regions, but probably more of an effect which most of us will recognise here is a lack of willingness for a lot of the national labour market to move out to the regions. I am under the view that regional Australia is actually much more innovative if we've learned how to survive with a lot of other challenges that's not faced by larger settlements or cities. So more with your view, not so much from what the RBA could deliver, is what would you suggest how we can draw more people to move out to the regions or for more businesses to accept a higher risk tolerance to invest out that way?
Yeah, I'm very reluctant to be drawn on kind of these type of policies. It's not my area of expertise, and the really issues of government policy, and the government doesn't advise me on my policy, thankfully. So I try not to advise the government on its policy, but I would agree with you, the capacity for innovation in regional Australia is immense. Having grown up in Wagga Wagga, I see that. That's another prosperous town that's doing well, and the capacity is here as well. But perhaps as you were speaking, it kind of triggered one thing in my mind about kind of risk aversion. You know, we all know the world's uncertain, don't we? And there's a lot that we could talk about the various uncertainties, and I talked about some of them today. But the uncertainty means that there are kind of outcomes in the left part of the tail and outcomes in the right part of the tail. The left part of the tail is bad, and the right part is good. And I feel too often as a society, we're focusing on the left part of the distribution. We're focusing on the risk, the downsides, at the expense of forgetting about the other side of the distribution, the upside. So we're spending huge amounts of resources as a society trying to deal with uncertainty on the downside and the possibility of bad outcomes. And if we focus too much on that, we'll lose the ability to seize the upside. And I think that's kind of an issue, not just for regional Australia, but for the country as a whole. The risk appetite, I saw a survey published in the press yesterday saying Australians have become very risk averse. And when you're risk averse, you focus on the downside of the distribution and not the upside. I think there's got to be some recalibration there.
Where we are at the moment.
Yeah, we're focusing too much on the possibility. Things could go wrong, it's all uncertain, and we're forgetting about the tremendous possibilities our country has. As I say, our fundamentals are incredibly strong. We could have an incredibly bright future, and we've got to focus on seizing that, not just on dealing with the downside. Yeah, that's another lecture, but I'll
keep going.
Yeah.
We've got some more questions, and can I just mention, Dr. Lowe's been very generous with his question time. If you do have questions, could you please come to the microphone now? It'll be a long time, I suspect, before a Reserve Bank of Australia governor is back.
I'll try and make it not so long.
Next question, please. Nice and close with that microphone.
Hi, I'm Nick, and I'm a student at Connacht Catholic College. And I was just wondering, would you say that the decrease in household consumer spending is due to in the Australian economy is due to consumers instead of starting to spend their money overseas through e-commerce?
I think it's an effect, but it's very much a marginal effect. And the other thing is Australians have decided to go overseas in record numbers. We don't just spend on online commerce, but we go on holidays overseas. There's an offset, though, because a lot of foreigners come on holiday in Australia. So I think that's pretty much a wash. The main reason consumption is weak because income growth is weak. For a few years, we could kind of pass off kind of wages and incomes rising at 2 or 3% a year as something temporary, but we can't pass it off as temporary anymore. I think more of us have realised that our incomes are not going to grow unless something changes at the old rate, and we've had to adjust our spending to that new reality.
Good evening, Dr. Lowe, Grant Devine from ADIG. Thank you for coming to Armidale. I've got two questions. One is around the payment system. It's probably a boring subject for most people.
Not to me.
No. I'm interested in your perspective of the major banks and their coming on board with the new payments platform and your view of that over the last couple of years and how successful that's been. And does it meet the RBA objectives in terms of innovation in the payment system? My second question is around your relationship with APRA and the counterintuitive sort of relationship in terms of credit squeeze and tightening in terms of the relation with APRA in terms of money supply within the economy, and also the aspects of the RBA in terms of we're looking to create more opportunities for growth, and your relationship with Wayne Byres and how you work together.
Well, I can answer that first. The relationship with APRA is excellent, and Wayne and I work incredibly well together. Just last week, I chaired the Council of Financial Regulators, so we catch up regularly, and we've got a kind of an outstanding relationship. I talk to my colleagues in other central banks, and they're often complaining about their relationship with their prudential supervisor. I never do that. And I always say, look, we've got a fantastic relationship between the central bank and the prudential regulator in Australia, so that's positive. Thanks for asking about payment innovation as well, because this allows me to give a plug here, because I hope you all have your pay IDs. No. Well, if you haven't, go and ask your bank for your pay ID, because if you get a pay ID, then you can move money between any two bank accounts in the country in 5 seconds, knowing just someone's mobile phone number. Forget about BSBs and account numbers. If you have a pay ID, then you can move money, no matter who you bank with, between two bank accounts in 5 seconds, just with your mobile phone number. So everyone please go and ask their bank for their pay ID and use the new system. It's fantastic. You know, people still complain about money, the time it takes to get money between banks. But those days are behind us, and if it's taking you a long time, then you're using old technology. So please use the new technology. The Reserve Bank has sponsored this system, and it's encouraged the banks to develop. The large banks have been tardy, and I constantly call them out over it. And maybe the fact that everyone doesn't have a pay ID here is because the large banks haven't all been actively marketing it to you because they've been slow. And this is one area where Australia's small financial institutions have done a fantastic job and the large banks have not. So if you bank with a large bank and your large bank isn't kind of advertising this system to you, go and complain to them, please. So maybe just two more. Yeah.
So we've got two more questions. Just on that point, I think there's a regional bank in this region that's already on the front of that curve with the electronic payments. So
that'll take that.
Next question.
Yes, I was going to say our regional Australia bank has been running that for 4 months.
Good.
We're usually ahead of the pack. I keep saying, if you want to get ahead financially, don't bank with the bank anyway. I'm Cameron Wade from Bellona Village. I'm down near the bottom for various circumstances that are beyond my control. And I'm a science physics person, so I look at economics from a very different perspective. So I wanted to ask you a question whether, I know as the with your role, and I feel a lot of public confidence in your institution, by the way, that you need to be very focused on the standard economics that our Western civilization in large part has established. But I'm wondering how much room do you have in Treasury to also look out for the fact that we may have some very unexpected changes globally in ways that are completely new and different scenarios. What capacity can you, do you have some capacity to look at the, to have people who are looking at the out-of-the-box scenarios as well as the standard expectation of things? And can I just give one example of this, to what I'm talking about? Over the last 20 years in Australia, we've had a very big focus to change from detaching us from seeing ourselves as part of Europe and the United States only, and pivoting to China and Asia. Which has been a good thing. We needed to break that old addiction. But I also notice that there's two remaining continents on this planet that over the next 50 to 100 years are going to be the major economic developments, and that's Africa and South America. And I notice that where a continent sits right between those two, very conveniently. So in terms of being Treasury, and I believe you probably have some role in looking at our long-term way to improve our prosperity as a nation, should we also be considering a relationship with these two continents and not just with China and Asia, so we're not so locked in, as an example of that out-of-the-box type thinking? So I'm really wondering, do you feel you've been adequately resourced on our behalf to consider these different scenarios as well as the standard economics?
Yeah, the resourcing of the Reserve Bank is very good. An effective organisation, and we're well-resourced, so I haven't got any complaints about lack of resourcing. We've got an economic research department, one of the few government entities that's been able to maintain a strong research department, and they're always, when I go and meet with them, they're always thinking of things out of the box, and sometimes I have to get them back into the box. But, there's a lot of free thinking within the Reserve Bank. We've got a very strong research department, and whether we should be looking kind of east and west more, I don't know the answer to that. That's beyond my normal time frame, but you know, I do think we need to develop stronger relationships with India and Indonesia, two incredibly populous countries that are going to hope do well over the next couple of decades, and we can benefit from that. And probably the last observation I'll make is diversification is always good, isn't it? So the more relationships we have, the better.
Thank you. I'll take that. I take real public confidence in that, because I think we do need to be active as a formation of that school you were showing to.
Yeah.
And also too, can you talk to some other significant people in government to come here more often, because it's been so fantastic to have you here.
That's not my job. My job is inflation control.
Just slipping in over a cup of tea.
So I didn't hear you.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on physical currency in Australia? Do you think eventually we'll move to a digital currency? And if so, how long will that be?
That's a very good question. It might surprise you to know that even though we're all kind of using tap and go payments, the stock of banknotes on issue at the moment relative to the size of the economy is the highest in more than 50 years. How many $100 notes do you think there are out there for every person in the country? The answer is 14 for every single person, and there are 30 $50 notes out there for every person. So there's still a lot of physical currency. I don't have my share. I don't know about you. So for some reason, I think I understand broadly why, people still want to hold banknotes. I don't think we're going to need a digital currency in Australia for regular payments, because we have the NPP and the new payments platform, and tomorrow you're all going to have your PAYDs. That system allows you to move money between bank accounts straight away. So I don't see why we would need a physical, a digital currency to sit alongside bank-to-bank transfers. So I could be wrong and new innovations come along, but I think if we're all using this new payment system, that's pretty much a digital currency, because we can move money between accounts instantaneously.
We'll make this the last question, please. And right up close again.
Thank you for the honour of having the last question. Dr. Lowe, thank you very much for your presentation for coming to Armidale. My question, you pointed to a number of issues: stagnant wage growth, low productivity growth, and also the reluctance of private businesses to invest. I noticed recently that UBS reported that most of the employment growth in Australia over the last few years has been in the public sector. Do you think that somehow contributes to these problems? Because public sector has wage gaps, it has low productivity, and the increased number of bureaucrats and regulations inhibits private sector investment, innovation, etc. Which really leads into my specific question. What specific structural reforms would you like to see governments in Australia undertake to lead to an opportunity for businesses to invest?
Again, my job isn't to advise the government, but you know, every time I appear before the parliamentary committees, they ask me the same questions. And every time they ask me that question, I say, well, go and read the reports you've commissioned. The government is very good at commissioning reports, and those reports have fantastic ideas in them, but we haven't implemented many of those ideas. And I'll just quickly read my list here that I give to them each time. I say it's kind of infrastructure, the way we select projects, the way we price infrastructure, and the way we share risk between the public and private sectors, the way we run the education system. Now, our comparative advantage up until now has really been built on what's in our land and what we can grow on our land, but increasingly our comparative advantage is going to be built from what's in our minds. So our education system is incredibly important, and there are endless reports on how to do that well. A third area is the culture of innovation and entrepreneurship. As I said before, we're too risk averse and we need to somehow address that. Anyone who looks at our tax system would not say it's kind of an optimally designed for productivity, where we tax land, the balance between consumption and income taxes, and the incentives for innovation in the tax system. And the final area would be the way we deliver government services. Government delivers services to many people in the country, and the government has the capacity to use big data to really improve the quality of those services. So, now this isn't my list, this is the list that comes from reading reports, which I've done. And I encourage others who are interested to read many reports there. Yeah, because we need to kind of create this environment where firms want, and this is the last time I'll say it, expand, innovate, invest and hire people. And if we addressed at least one or two of these areas, I think we could make a difference. Thank you.